I'd like to say that what Alan has been talking about is the most powerful subject in the world at the moment. He's touching 10,000 volts. Because whoever controls the money in the world controls the whole thing, quite obviously. He quoted that statement of Rothschild's. Give me permission to issue the money of a nation, and I care not who makes its laws. So I want to just elaborate a little bit on that and try and give you perhaps a bit of Australian history and a bit of background to what all that is about. Just the other day, in the middle of March, we had a gathering up in Quebec City in Canada. 25,000 protesters were there. It ended up in wild violence with large numbers of police and ordinary people being hurt in the process. It was the scene for the trial of a new crowd control weapon, which is an electromagnetic beam. And if you shine this beam, it will reach people 400 meters away and virtually immobilize them. It just penetrates about half the distance or the thickness of your skin and makes you so itchy that you just cannot stand still. And as soon as it's turned off, you can move again. And they tried this thing out, and it seemed to work, but it didn't stop the bloodshed. Now, that meeting that was held in Quebec City was about extending NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Association that Alan was mentioning, that big block, into a free trade association that will cover all the Americas. Every nation in America was there attending, and it would be a block that would become a dollar block extending from the Arctic Circle down to Cape Horn. That's a pretty big area. Did you know that during the last 18 months, 7 countries have abandoned their own money systems and have accepted the American dollar as their official currencies now? And that the proposition currently being discussed in Southeast Asia is, if Indonesia can't hang together, and it's unlikely that it can, because if you think about Indonesia, which is only just to our north, it is an archipelago of 13,000 islands, 26 different races with their own languages, and it is the biggest Islamic country in the world. And it is exploding. Whether Gus Dore, as he's called, or Wahid can remain in power is questionable. But if he does go, there's going to be an expansion of civil war. But the proposition behind all that is that they should abandon their own money system and accept the American dollar as the official currency of Indonesia. Now, all this ties in with the idea that we are gradually being edged and shoved and moved towards the replacement of national currencies with some sort of global currency or at least regional currency. Whether the Asia-Pacific Economic Community ends up as a yen block or a dollar block is immaterial. Basically, we'd lose the right to run our own money systems. So Alan raised the question, which is a pretty good question, would this be a good thing or would it be a bad thing? My own belief is that the argument in the world is about something called sovereignty. Who will be sovereign? And there's only two ideas about sovereignty. The one is that sovereignty is simply the accumulation of a commodity called power. And you can exercise this power and you can produce the results that you want. And right through the whole of human history, we've had people trying to accumulate this stuff called power, whether it was Alexander the Great or whether it was Genghis Khan or whether it was Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin, all of them wanted power. And most of them were idealistic. They had this feeling, if I had the power, I could make everything very good for everybody and they would all love me. So quite obviously, if we ended up with some sort of global system or world government, we would have a greater accumulation of power than has ever been seen in the whole history of humankind. And those who are pushing this idea say, look, we've now got the technology, we've got the brains to produce peace on earth. give us all the brains and give us the best computers, and we'll produce a spreadsheet, and everybody's going to be happy from there on. That's one idea. The opposite idea to that is that the source of sovereignty is not in your nation or your community, it's in here. That each person has a little bit of sovereignty that I believe is God-given, and with that sovereignty you can develop your life. And everybody's going to do this differently because we're all absolutely unique. There are no two people the same. Everybody has different talents. Everybody has a different purpose. Now you can share your sovereignty to produce a result, but you lose your freedom if you also lose the right to retract out if the thing doesn't suit what you believe is right. And there is no meeting point between those two ideas. Either you believe in personal freedom and you honor the freedom of your neighbor, or else you believe that's expendable in producing a certain specified result by the accumulation of power. All of us have to make that choice. Now, something has happened in Australia. It is very, very dramatic. Part of it is the energy in this room today. Part of it is an energy that is spreading from community to community, and it's very different from what happened when I began speaking, which was 34 years ago, believe it or not. I've been going around shouting my mouth off for 34 years. We went through all that period when we had the Vietnam demonstrations, and then we went through a long period where people were so appalled at what was happening they tried to contract out. We had a huge movement into alternative lifestyles, and we had the flower people. But you can't contract out of that. And so the new mood is one of we get together and we really synergize to get the results that we want. And that is a brilliant new development. And part of it is demonstrated in what happened in Quebec City, or the S11 demonstrations in Melbourne, or the huge demonstrations in Prague they had the other day, or whatever it happens to be, Seattle. And all of this now is organized by the very technology that is often used against us through the internet. Hundreds and thousands of people are now networking and are getting news that you don't get through the major media. And with that news, they're beginning to shape new purposes, and they're not going to surrender their sovereignty, and it's a great change. But control of money is the key to the whole thing. Just about 30 years ago, 1971, I was invited here in Brisbane to go before the Country Party, it used to be called, and the management committee called a special meeting to try and discuss how they were going to save farmers in Australia. And we had at that stage over 200,000 farmers in this country. And I was one of three speakers to be invited to put forward propositions. And my proposition was quite simple. We had to use our own money system here in Australia, and we had to get capital available to farmers at 2 or 3% interest if they were going to survive. And the other two speakers, one was an economist from University of Queensland whose idea was, we've got too many farmers, let's get rid of them. And the second one was a fairly venerable economist who used to write for the Sunday Mail called H.W. Herbert. Some of the older people here just might remember him. He'd been a farmer and then he became an economist. He had some good ideas. But I got up to speak. And all of a sudden, out of that management committee, a guy got up and ripped into me. This is absolute nonsense, talking about funny money and producing money and using our own credit. He said, we've been through all this in the Depression, it's a load of rubbish, and this guy's talking funny money. And I got all hot under the collar and I swore at him, and it ended up in a great battle. And finally the chairman, whose name was Bob Sparks, I don't know if anybody remembers that name, called a halt and said, we better have lunch and cool off. Fair enough. But the guy who'd attacked me, when the room had cleared, came across to me and said, come and have a beer with me. We walked out of the hotel, which was in George Street, went across to a bar and we had a beer and sat down. And he said, of course, you're absolutely right, you know. But you know as well as I do what would happen if we picked this up. We'd lose, I mean, look at the overdraft our party has got. Look at the donations that we expect from the big companies. All that would dry up. We wouldn't win the next election. Now, he happened to be the Federal Minister for Agriculture, and his name was Charlie Adamant. And not only was he a politician, but he gave a Sunday school, one-hour broadcast from Kingaroy every week, and he did that for 50 years on standing for the truth and all that stuff. So we went back at 2 o'clock, and this guy who told me I was right got up and attacked me again. Oh, funny money, we can't have any of that rubbish. By that time I was pretty speechless. He then retired from Parliament and got a knighthood, and I was producing a newspaper in the rural areas of Queensland called Queensland Calling, and he agreed to become the patron of it, and he wrote some good articles on money. Once he'd got out, he'd got his pension and was out of the battle, he was prepared to tell the truth. So it's not a question of logic, it's a question of huge power movement. And I want to tell you some of the things that are important about that. You might remember the last election when One Nation stood for office in Canberra. They put forward a suggestion that they ought to produce a bank to finance small business and farmers in Australia to the tune of $150 million. And that was as though a bomb went off. And on the 7:30 report that night, the Treasurer of Australia sat down very seriously, Peter Costello, and said, "This is absolute danger. If we start creating money to finance people, we're going to end up in Germany with wheelbarrows of marks that would only buy you a loaf of bread." And he said, "This has been peddled round Australia by odd conspiracy theorists." And he held up a newsletter, which I had written 20 years ago that night, about how we could use our own money in Australia to get our own sovereignty back. He didn't tell anybody where it came from or who wrote it, but you were supposed to get the message. This was thoroughly dangerous. Okay. We're celebrating the centenary of Federation this year. And 100 years ago, Australia became a nation with its own flag and its own central parliament, and all the states handed some power in, and we became what is today the Commonwealth of Australia. At the time it happened, we had the highest standard of living in the world, which was a brilliant achievement, because only 100 years previous to that, or a little over 100 years, the first settlers had arrived at Botany Bay in ancient, creaky sailing ships, and over one-third of those who arrived in the first fleet as convicts died either in the journey or in the harbour after the ships landed. And they just took the dead bodies and tipped them over the side in Botany Bay. And the doctor records in his diary, if you want to read the story, "We saw white naked bodies lying on the rocks all round the harbour. There wasn't a building, there wasn't a road, there wasn't a map. Nobody knew what lay inside this country. They had a few chooks and they had a few seeds, and that was about it. And within 100 years, or just about over 100 years, we were the highest standard of living in the world. Nothing like it has ever been done before." And all this stuff about Australians cringing and not being proud of their culture is rubbish, because what we did was brilliant. We opened up the whole of this area. We had Cobb and Co. using 2,400 horses a day as they developed the transport system. We'd built a transcontinental railway. And we hadn't got in debt. And then we came together and we formed One Nation, and we opened our first parliament, and one of the first things that happened was that we had a very colourful character by the name of O'Malley, who was a member of parliament for a Tasmanian seat, who'd been a banker in America and had also been a head of a church. I don't know what the name of the church was, but it was a pretty rough mob, I think. And O'Malley said in parliament, "If this young nation is to retain its sovereignty and its freedom, we've got to finance ourselves. Because if we start borrowing money overseas and get this nation into debt, we will simply become slaves in some future time." And in the speech he made in Parliament, he said, "What we're debating here is about the future of our kids and future generations. And what we ought to do is to start a people's bank that can do what Alan pointed out, create our own money, as a measured expansion against the expansion of the physical Australia." And after a lot of debate and a lot of opposition, incidentally, in 1911, they opened up a little bank in the middle of Melbourne, the Commonwealth Bank of Australia. It was a people's bank. It didn't belong to the private sector. They bought a second-hand building, and they wanted to make it look nice. They made two nice bronze doors, which they always do, of course, and he walked in through that, and behind a counter there was a young Australian by the name of Miller, Denison Miller, who'd got this job from the Bank of New South Wales. Anybody know what the Bank of New South Wales is now? Westpac. Used to be the Bank of New South Wales. He'd applied for the job for this new bank, and they said, all right, you're the sole boss. You're the director. There'll be no board. You just run this bank. And he said, well, that's easy enough to say, but I haven't even got any money of my own. Oh, they said, we better give you a kitty to start with. So they took £10,000, and we were on pounds then, out of the government revenue, and they put it in this funny little bank in Collins Street and said, away you go. And that money was repaid within 24 hours. £10,000. And he started making deals. He went to the Melbourne Board of Works, which borrowed all its money on the London money market, and said, what do you pay? And they said 6.5%. He said, I can do you the same job for 4% or under 4%. And he signed up. The first deal the Commonwealth Bank ever made was for over £1 million for the Melbourne Board of Works. And only a few months later, because the bank officially opened in 1913, they had to fight a war. Now, what normally happens in a war? You get debt after debt after debt after debt. Britain borrowed all the money to fight that First World War in America on Wall Street and is still paying the debt off. She has paid the First World War debt 2.5 times and currently owes more than she borrowed. The final payment is scheduled in the year 2004, but she's not going to make it because she's dropping behind. Australia didn't do that. They went to this funny little bank in Collins Street and said, can you finance the war? And he said, yes. How much do you want? And they said, well, big bickies. We've got to turn the whole economy round to wartime production. We've got to turn farmers into soldiers. We've got to stop building tractors and build tanks and warships. Well, he said, I can do that. So he got a Commonwealth Bank check and he wrote, payable to Department of Defence, £350 million. And they said, why? Because that was a lot of money. Well, that's terrific. What's the rate? What do we have to repay? He said, well, I've got to charge you something, because under the legislation which set the bank up, I've got to make a profit. So I'll charge you interest, and the interest will be 0.625%. That is a fraction over 0.5%. And on that interest rate, the Commonwealth Bank made a profit of £20 million in the 4 years of the war, on 0.5% interest. Now, this was so dramatic and so different from what England and the other countries had done that in 1920, in June, Denison Miller was over in London fixing up a deal on what had happened to Australian wool, because there'd been a lot of wool there that hadn't been paid for. And he had a press conference, which is in the papers. And they said to him, how did you finance the war in Australia? He said, we used the People's Bank. Yeah, but I mean, what was the limit? He said, the limit was what the Australian people could do. Yeah, but what does that mean? Well, he said, I'll give you an example. Let's suppose we wanted to build a warship. We ask questions like this. Do we have enough steel? Yes. Do we have a dry docks to build it in? Yes. Do we have engineers? Yes. Do we have painters? Yes. Do we have a crew that's going to go on this ship when it's made? Yes. All right, there's the check, get it done. The limiting factor is the materials and the know-how and the manpower. Well, they said, what was the limit? He said, the limit, we reckoned, was that we could have fought that war all over again had we had to do so, because we had that much reserves of material. The price we paid were in the dead who died on the battlefield. But there wasn't a financial price. Incidentally, during that war in 1915, we built the Transcontinental Railway from Perth to Sydney with Australian steel made at Newcastle and Australian men, and we didn't borrow a cent. The money was just released through the bank and written off as that railway was built. Think of that as we're now building a new railway from Melbourne right up in a circle to Darwin. It's going to be foreign owned before it even started. So they said to Dennis and Miller, well, if you could do that in wartime, could you do it in peace? And he said, yes. What's the limit? And he said, the limit's exactly the same. Only this time we don't need to build warships. We can build schools, or we could build footy fields, or we could just drop taxis down so that they're an incident. We could do anything we want, and what should be done is decided by the people through their parliament. So it came to the crunch question, where do you get the money? He said, we created it. And they all fell about holding their heads saying, oh God, you can't create money. Didn't you know that? That's the 11th commandment out of the Bible. Creating money is inflationary. You're going to end up like Germany. So he pulled a £5 note out of his pocket and he held it up and he said, would you agree this came off a printing press? And they didn't quite know how to answer that. Finally, a young, naive reporter said, yeah, well, obviously it came off a printing press. Well, he said, the only question now is the printing press inside Australia or is it outside Australia? If it is inside Australia, we run our own destiny. If it's outside Australia, we lose our country. And that's the key to the whole thing. Now, we're about somewhere between 85% and 90% foreign-owned now. We are, I think, equal number one in the world for the level of foreign ownership. And we've just had a huge survey done in this country by Quantum Research. Now we have polls, you know, every time there's going to be a vote or an election, and the polls are normally pretty crazy and they have bets on whether horse one's going to win or horse two's going to win, and mostly they get it wrong. But this Quantum Research program that they have is run every year in Australia. It's very extensive and they sell the results for $20,000, and it is bought by banks and insurers and governments and parties. And this one, they've just had a big write-up on it in The Australian, and it was very interesting, their conclusion. The first conclusion was, we are entering the most volatile period in Australian history. People are really angry with what is going on. And the issues that came out were these. Certainly, multinational companies are spooked by the resurgence of public interest in Australian-made known products, with food and pharmaceuticals on the front line. Kraft has taken to full-page print advertisements to reminding peanut butter buyers that its brand is made from 100% Queensland peanuts and supports Australian farmers and families. They don't tell you, though, that the profits go out of this country. Australia Scan says companies should expect more volatility, should 60% of the 2,000 annual respondents believe globalization is dangerous and a threat to our way of life. Although asked before the outbreak of foot and mouth disease in the UK, public concerns about food poisoning were up 17% in the year to 71%, genetically modified food up 12% to 63%, electromagnetic radiation up 10% to 49%, and gambling addiction up 7% to 34%. So the issues that are bugging Australians are basically about what is going to happen to our sovereignty. They went on to say that over 60% of Australians are sick of sleaze and sex in TV ads, which is the dead opposite of what you'd expect if you watch Channel 10 and Channel 9. People have had a gutful of it. They're not wowsers. They just are sick of having it stuffed down their throat the whole time. So something is happening that is dramatic, and we've got to work out how we got here and what is going to happen about it. You see, go back to that Commonwealth Bank in just before 1924, 1923, this young guy who'd run the bank so successfully died. Very young, unexpectedly. And in 1924, we had a federal election, and they changed all the legislation. And they took that Commonwealth Bank, and they said, we've got to put this under a board, you know. You can't just have one person running it. And so they established a board that came from the private banks. And they made sure that bank never competed against the private sector ever again. And within, 6 years of that, we were in the second great disaster of this century, the Great Depression, which none of us know anything about. But if you'd lived in Australia at that time, the agony was intense. There was no dole. There was, you could only get a handout if you walked to different places. You could never pick it up at the same place twice. So they had over 1 million Australians walking along the road, many of whom would just work all day for a loaf of bread. They would chop wood or do anything. The only thing that kept this nation together was the digger spirit. Everybody was trying to help everybody else, but it was agonizing. And yet there was more production in Australia than ever before. How can we all starve when we got so much food? How can we actually be jobless when there's so much to do? And he wrote a pamphlet at the time, because the British government, which for now was back lending to Australia, sent out two emissaries to Australia who said, you've got to pay your debts, Australia, before the people even eat. And so Billy Hughes wrote this on the Great Depression. It's staggering stuff. Nothing better exemplifies the baffling complexity of modern production than the present situation in Australia. Trade is depressed, our unemployed are numbered by tens of thousands who walk the streets of our great cities and tramp the country roads downcast and in many cases dependent for food upon charity. While their country is a veritable Garden of Eden in which blooms in luxuriant profusion almost everything that man could desire, we have a population of a little over 6 million people, many now in sad trouble. Yet we shall produce this year enough wheat to feed 30 millions, enough wool to clothe 100 millions, and meat, butter, dried fruit, sugar, and other kinds of food and raw materials, including minerals and metals, sufficient for double or treble the present population. And yet they say Australia is in a bad way because we produce too little. Wealth in abundance meets the eye on every hand, yet men are unemployed and trade is depressed. Surely the trouble does not rise because we produce too little. Yet Sir Otto, the guy they'd sent out from England, says we ought to produce more. And a new slogan came in. The world is short of materials, everybody's got to work harder, tighten their belts and produce more. And they're doing exactly the same now in the year 2001. What happened was the Depression was used to repeat what had happened in America, at Jekyll Island, where they established a central bank that was privately owned, and they tried to get central banking in every nation. And we ended up under central bank economics, which is disastrous. And they're now trying to merge the central banks into one world central bank to control the whole thing, if you want to follow up what's going on. So there was design behind it, and this design finally blew out into the open. There was a lot of speculation during the Depression about whether there is a conspiracy, or how does the money system work? All the economists said, it's not a money problem, it's a production problem. All we've got to do is tighten our belts and export more and get more money back from overseas, and that's going to fix everything up. And the chief economist for the whole of Australia, whose name was Douglas Copeland, held a big meeting in the town hall in Melbourne to give his theory, how to work our way out of the Depression. Tighten our belts, pretty hard stuff if you're starving. Work harder, ridiculous if you can't get a job, and let's export it. 2,000 people went into the Melbourne town hall to hear his theory. And at the end, there wasn't much of a clap. But there was a question period, and a farmer got up and he asked a question. Tell me, Sir Douglas, you say if we import less and export more, we're going to be better off. That's it, said Sir Douglas Copeland. Okay, well, if we increased our exports by 25%, cut down on our imports by 25%, things are going to be really good. You're sure right, he said. So if we increased our exports by 50% and cut our imports down by 50%, we're going to be better off still. Sure. Well, said this farmer, suppose we exported every bloody thing we've got. We cut our imports down to nil. According to your theory, we've reached the promised land. And 2,000 people rose to their feet and booed Sir Douglas Copeland out of the hall. Now, we're being persuaded that the problem is basically a production problem in the world at the moment. The way to get out of that is lean and mean, free trade, and everybody export to everybody else, and somehow that's going to fix it up. And if we could double our exports out of Australia, we're going to be better off than anybody else. There's only one problem with that theory, and that is that every nation in the world is being told the same thing. And if every nation is trying to export its way out of debt, how do you solve it? Particularly when the evidence is now out, which came out from an economist at McGill University in Canada, who decided to look at this picture, and he put every export and every import in the world onto a computer to try and get a model out, right at the end of the 80s, and when he finally got every deal in place and every payment in place, out of this computer came a model that just blew everything. The world was now running a trade deficit with itself of over $100 billion every 12 months, which blows every economic theory taught to every university student out of the water. They're always taught that trade balances. If there's a deficit here, there's a credit there, and if you ever got a picture of the whole thing, it would nicely balance. So he wrote to the International Monetary Fund, Professor R.T. Naylor, and he said, are you aware of this? And after 3 months, they wrote back saying, yes, we are. The figures have shown us this, but there is no logical explanation for it. So we just put it in our balance sheet every year under the heading of asymmetries. If you don't remember anything else I say, just remember the word asymmetries. Very useful. Somebody comes up to you and asks you a technical question. You don't know what the answer is. You just walk away in a lordly fashion and say, well, that comes under the heading of asymmetries. And they all say, oh, what a genius. I never thought of that. What it means is I haven't got the first clue what the answer is. But if we've produced a financial system that compounds the deficit every year, and we say to all the ingredient parts, there's only one way to solve your economic dilemma, and that is to trade your way out of it. We've got the ingredients for the biggest human conflict of all. So the thing blew out of the water when a top historian in America produced a book in the 60s. His name was Carol Quigley, Tragedy and Hope. And Tragedy and Hope was called Tragedy and Hope, The History of the World in Our Time. And Carol Quigley, who was the best-known historian in America, said, I have been given access to the private papers of a group of international banks who are going to use the money system to try and produce a world government. He said, actually, I think there's some good ideas behind that. But he said, it finally solves the problem about whether there is such a thing as a planned movement for world government or not. And the actual book contained these words. I know of this operation. I know of the operation of this network because I have studied it for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the early 60s to examine its papers and secret records. I have objected both in the past and recently to a few of its policies, but in general my chief difference is that it wishes to remain unknown. The names of some of these other banking families are familiar to all of us and should be more so. They include Baring, Lazard, Erlanger, Warburg. The Warburg started the Jekyll Island thing. Schroeder, Seligman, Spears, Mirabeau, Mallet, Fold, and above all, Rothschild and Morgan. These are the companies who want total world control of the financial system and control of all governments. Now, it was such a thick tome that it was only read by a few academics, and they thought that's as far as it would go, but somebody got hold of it and decided to synthesize what he had said down and put in a little paperback, which came out about 1970-71, and it was called None Dare Call It Conspiracy. Did you ever hear of that book? None Dare Call It Conspiracy became the biggest paperback ever sold in the world. Sold over 20 million copies. And it never went through a bookshop. But it simply told the story of the movement, which was coming, incidentally, both from communism and capitalism to try and establish some sort of central globalized control. And we're now right in the final stages of the whole thing. And that means that once you have every nation dependent on foreign capital, trying to export its way into some sort of stability, and you can produce a rule which says no nation shall produce its own money, you've got the thing sewn up. Back in 1996, just after John Howard got in as the Prime Minister of Australia, we had the biggest meeting of international bankers in Australia's history. And their meeting was written up in the Australian Financial Review. They met right through the morning, and then at midday, John Howard was brought in like a kid to meet the schoolmaster. And this is how the article, which appeared in the Financial Review, actually read. Right, let me glasses. Said this: as John Howard swept into the chandeliered banquet hall to address top executives of 100 of the world's biggest banks this week, he could hardly have known that a trap had been laid for him. He'd only been in, what, 6 weeks? The bankers, the most internationally influential audience Mr. Howard has confronted since taking office, had spent half a day discussing the price they would demand from countries around the world for bankrolling them. In an increasingly capital-thirsty world, international financiers, the commissars of capital, have become modern potentates with the power to dictate policy to states which have long considered themselves sovereign. By the time Mr. Howard took the lectern in Sydney, the speakers of the invitation-only International Monetary Conference had already set out a checklist of policies. Most explicit was the chairman of the big U.S. investment bank Goldman Sachs and Company, Mr. John Corzine, a former central banker, who was asked by the group to specify conditions for what he called the inherently blunt process that leaves many worthy initiatives and investments without resources. Sir John Corzine is picked by the bankers to tell Mr. Howard what their conditions are. One, tax reform. The GST was and is an international monetary fund tax. You will put it in, even though you said never ever, that's not good enough. You've got to stop running trade deficits. You've got to balance your books. You've got to control your public service. And above all, you are never to run a financial deficit again. Now, when a nation issues its own credit, that is termed running a deficit. It's quite a good thing when things are tight. But John Howard was told, you are not to create any money in Australia. We do that now, and we're the international boys. John Howard just put his hands up and said, well, if that's what we need for foreign investment, that's the price we're prepared to pay. And that is why we have sold asset after asset. And our treasurer and our prime minister tell us with gravity that our future depends on further foreign capital pouring into Australia. But what's the price we pay? If you think it makes any difference if we throw him out and put Beazley out, you're kidding yourself, because Beazley is committed to the same program. So really what we've got is we've got a globalist program which is not just economic, it is a political thing, which aims at moving through the three trade blocks that Alan was talking about towards some final global administration. We've had many people warned about this. High Court judges have said this means the end of democracy in Australia. The government takes its orders not from the people, but from international agencies. That's the price we pay. We've got that, and all of a sudden we've got an awakening here in Australia that is very dramatic, and that awakening is happening right around the world. That is why we're getting these big protests. I don't know if that's the best way to go. It's got to get more intelligent than that. We've got to learn to apply sanctions, but the question is whether you keep your freedom and whether your kids are going to have a stake in this country or not. And if we can't be bothered to do it, we're going to raise a generation, the next generation, even younger than you are now, who are going to ask us tough questions. Their mums and their dads. Is it true, Dad, that at one stage Australians owned their own businesses and their own farms, and they were allowed to own their own homes on their own private blocks of land, and they could have their own investments? Is that actually going to happen? Was it true that was like that in Australia once, and Dad will say, yeah, it was. I can remember that when I was a bit younger, you know, it was like that.
hundreds of farmers out there. This country belonged to these strangers.
How did we lose it, Dad? Well, our politicians told us that we had to borrow more and more money, and we sold our ports and our harbors and our airports and our shops and our minerals and our industries. And more and more money went overseas. The banks were the only ones who made profits. The banks at the moment are making 27 million bucks a day. You probably know that. We actually send out of Australia $100 million every 24 hours in dividends and profits to foreign owners, which should be staying here in Australia. So that's what happened, son. What did you do about it, Dad? Well, I wasn't too sure, son. I was a bit nervous. You know, if you stuck your neck out, you could have been downsized. You could have lost your job. You were sometimes called an extremist in the papers. They reckoned you were a nut. So I just tried to ignore what was going on. I knew this was happening, but me and my mates, we just kept quiet. And we used to come back at the end of a desperate day's work, thankful we hadn't lost our jobs, and we used to be able to sit down and watch television. Most of the stations were foreign-owned. I'd sit there in the evening with a stubby made by a Japanese or New Zealand company, of course. And thank God footy was on. I could watch the Reds versus the Blues, or I could watch St. George versus Parramatta. I noticed, and I was nervous about this, that even the footy teams were getting bought up by the multinationals. And then, son, there was this terrible fortnight. I don't know how I got through it when footy ended before cricket began. I don't know how I got through it. I used to go down and whinge in the pub, and then, thank God, Warney came on. Mark Waugh made a century. Everything was beaut again. And I could forget all about it. What the hell are our kids going to think of us? The first generation of Australians that wouldn't fight for this country. They would go back and they would think of our fathers and our grandfathers. You know that the Turks are astounded by the number of young Australians at that dawn service at Gallipoli, remembering our grandfathers. The generation that gave us our freedom. We think, as I've told before, one of the most precious things I've got is a tape. Goes for 20 minutes, played by four people who came back from Changi during the Second World War. They had had the hell beaten out of them. They'd been ground down on the Burma Railway. They'd been beaten up. They'd worked for 16 hours a day. Finally, they'd ended up in Changi, a brutal place. And the greatest survival rate was amongst the Australians. They cherished each other. They were fiercely loyal to each other. If one was sick or had been wounded, they'd gladly sacrifice their rice ration, even though it wasn't enough for one, so that they could get him through. 15,000 died. And every Sunday evening, they would get up onto what they called One Tree Hill in the middle of Changi. And the pastor of the camp, who was a pretty tough character, used to run a church service just as the sun went down. He said they'd often crawl up on their hands and knees. And he said they asked some pretty tough questions. Pastor, according to the faith you push, we're supposed to love our enemies. How do you love these bastards who are beating us up every day? And the pastor said, I didn't know how to answer, except to say you can't keep nurturing hatred. Somehow you have to deal with it. Might take you a year or two. And then he said, as the sun went down, that always they'd often talk after the service, how they were getting on. But he said there was always a hush as the sun came down. He said, I'd look at that big group on One Tree Hill, and they'd all be looking south down to where Australia was. And he said, I knew they were thinking of home. Little block tucked into the Great Dividing Range, little home in a suburb in Brisbane or Adelaide, have a girlfriend, a couple of kids, and their spirits were burning to get back to their own home, their free country. And then one day the Japanese flag came down and up went the Union Jack. It wasn't the Aussie flag, because two Britishers had managed to piece together a Union Jack out of bits of cloth. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter whether it was the Aussie flag. They did pull the Aussie flag up in a nearby camp. And he said we were free. Great story. They went through that for Australia. And there's an even more dramatic story about the women who were in a slave labor camp in Sumatra, just up here. It's only just across the sea from Australia. Thousands of women packed in. And the one who put that together was an Australian woman, because they were losing their faith and their hope so fast. And she said, we meet even if it's at midnight after the day's work, and we've got to talk, and we've got to build each other up, and let's sing our national songs. There were so many races they couldn't even converse together, and so many languages. And so each nation used to sing their songs, 10 or 11 o'clock at night after 16 hours of work and being beaten up. And then they ran out of songs, and she put together a human orchestra. She divided the whole of that camp up. She wrote the music from memory, from old scores and oratorios and operas. And one group of women were cellos, and one group of women were violins, and another group were flutes, and another group were clarinets. And one evening, up into this camp, went the sound of a human orchestra. And the commandant, who was over 6 foot, which is very unusual for the Japanese people, and was really brutal, came down. He wasn't going to have this. And he came in and he heard what must have been an angelic sound, and he stopped and bowed and backed out. One Australian woman. And after it was finished, after the war was over, they ran a concert in Adelaide. And the remnants of that camp repeated their human orchestra. And the whole of the audience who'd come to hear were in tears as they heard the sounds of literally angels going up. That's our heritage. That's what every kid in Australia should be taught. Most of them have never heard of it. They know instinctively something happened. That's why they go to Gallipoli. But they've never been told the story of how freedom was won in this country. And now a group of bloody money people think they're going to take it away from us. And they bought the politicians. I'm sorry to tell you this, but they have bought the politicians. They just do it with handouts. What's Peter Beattie doing, speaking at a luncheon on the Gold Coast in a couple of weeks? $2,000 a plate. We know it's corruption. They've done it to the Liberals and the Labour and the National. They've bought our politicians. And somehow we've got to get it back. And the only hope we've got are groups like your own, young Australians coming through. You're incredibly important. Each one of you, you might say, I can't do anything. If you can do no more than spend $50 out of your housekeeping budget on Australian-made products, you're making a difference. If we could get every housewife in Australia to do that, we'd knock $20 billion a year off our foreign debt. We'd begin to get this company back. And this movement is sweeping right through. It's got them petrified. They don't know what to do about it. Dick Smith may not have it all right, but I tell you what, he's saying the right message. We've got to get Australia back. Sovereignty belongs to us, to each of us and our kids. And if we can do that, what a great country Australia's going to be. It's a sad country at the moment. But it's going to be a great country. And it's going to be great, not because we're powerful and have atomic weapons, but because each of us is fiercely loyal to this idea of freedom. We're a free country, and the title deeds belong to us. We don't want to oppose any other nation, but we do want the title deeds to our own backyard. And if we do that, people will say, God, those Aussies got it right. Best place in the world to go, you know. Their mateship is extraordinary. Their freedom is incredible. The humor is abundant. And that's what I'm looking forward to. Thank you very much. Good.